I'd like to start by talking or asking you to talk a little bit about the basic elements of style of Hong Kong film. And I expect when you say that phrase, people may have some associations. They may have seen some of these movies. They may have not. Are there essential elements of style, things that are the distinguishing marks of the Hong Kong film, particularly the action film?
Not really. We have all different kinds of the... I think we have so many different kinds, but only some of them you see it before, but most likely a lot of things, I don't think Western people see it at all.
It's, yes, you see things in these movies that you don't see. If you haven't seen a film like that before, you probably haven't seen those kinds of things, right?
The things are it's true, I think, that there's a sense in which the first Hong Kong movie anyone sees, you think, wow, this is really unbelievable, and you tend to think it's unique. But then you realize that there is a very big tradition behind almost everything that you see, and that things that people thought are startling and new actually probably have a long history. I think the example might be Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon, where recently people came out of the theater saying, wow, women doing kung fu, women doing swordplay, this is fantastic. But this is a very old Chinese tradition in literature, in folklore, and in film. But it was just that Crouching Tiger brought it to people's awareness in the West to a degree that it hadn't been before.
Mm. Only too, Hong Kong film has very strong connections with films made in China, Taiwan, and things like that. So I think if we say a very distinct Hong Kong film style, it might not be easy to say that, to make this kind of essentialized idea. And I mean, right now, we saw a lot of action movie. We thought that is Hong Kong, or very quick action, or a lot of still effect. But I think that's only a small part of the Hong Kong films. And some of them might be mainly for the global audience. So I think that is really...
But I still think it's different. I still think different. Mm-hmm. Different Hong Kong film is different with a Taiwan film and China film. Mm-hmm. You can tell, you know, the tempo is much faster than, faster than the other two, right? Mm-hmm. Especially China. They slow down a little bit. Mm-hmm. And also the way they presenting, you know, different too. Mm-hmm. I think more modern. Mm-hmm. Even though it's classical, I think it's more modern than the other. Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. How about if I ask a question rather than talking about visual style, because these films are certainly marked by a very distinct and strong visual style. If I ask a question about dramatic themes, mm-hmm. are there, do you think, particular dramatic themes that tend to occur again and again in these movies?
That's true, though.
Yeah. I think that is true. I think that at one level, a lot of the kung fu films, again, to take them as a separate genre, there are many other genres in Hong Kong cinema, and I don't want to suggest that this is pervasive, but there is a strong element of morality that depends very much on kinship, loyalty to one's teacher, loyalty to one's best friend. These elements come back again and again. And in a lot of the kung fu films, it's usually when one of those is violated, the plot turns on revenge, on getting vengeance, or bringing justice because of the wrongs that have been committed. And that theme of loyalty to one's kin, loyalty to one's teacher, to one's best friend, that, though it has a lot of Western equivalents, I think does have a very strong resonance for Hong Kong audiences, but also Chinese audiences generally. Mm-hmm.
I agree too, actually. I think because of the new Hong Kong cinema, you know, Hong Kong, there's two kinds. One is the Mandarin cinema, and other is Cantonese cinema, it's local dialect. I think in the 50s, for example, when the Shaw Brothers really began to launch a new age of cinema in Hong Kong, I think there is a very strong sense of nationalism and in a very nostalgic tone. Because many of the people were just diaspora, they just left out of China and came to Hong Kong and other parts of the world. So that is a very strong mark of that. And also in these couple of decades, I think a search for a certain sense of Hong Kong local identities is also very important. That kind of that sense of in between mainland and Hong Kong. Mm-hmm. So what is that make Hong Kong distinct from China, from other parts of the world? So that is also become one of the very strong thematic things of Hong Kong cinema, modern style, because they have some quick style, low style. But I think that is one thing very important. They kind of stress on on the local identities, but always make projected through the family dramas and all those things.
Yeah, and I suppose we certainly should make the point that I guess when people talk about Hong Kong cinema, they think about action films, whether they are period films or whether they're set, they're contemporary films, and that they're every other kind of film was made. You've got musicals, you've got love stories, you've got comedies. So it's a complete. All the same kind of films you're going to see anywhere are being made in Hong Kong, even if the ones that seem to get a lot of the attention are action.
I think it's because it's more easy to understand, though. Mm-hmm. Because we have a culture different. You might don't understand, Asia people's culture, right? Mm-hmm. But for the action, it's body language. I think it's more easy for any kind of culture can accept it, That's why I think the action movie is more interesting to them.
Well, have these kinds of films, they were widely watched, they may not now, but were also widely watched elsewhere in East and Southeast Asia. They were exported from there to the rest of Asia.
Right. Yes, they are
East Asia. That's right.
In fact, the company that this conference is focusing on, the Shaw Brothers Enterprise, really had its roots in a kind of East Asian and Southeast Asian network of markets, of theaters which were owned by the company, distribution outlets, alliances with other companies, and that in a sense these Hong Kong movies were made as much for the Chinese diaspora as they were made for the local audience. Mm-hmm. In some cases, the Mandarin movies particularly, they were made more for the Chinese diaspora than for the local audience.
Actually, Hong Kong is too small a market for film industry to survive. Uh-huh. So the overseas diasporic communities of Chinese were always very important and modern source of support for the film industry. So,
That's interesting because I think I also have read one of the reasons for the decline of the industry has been that Chinese diaspora, that younger people that, it might be their parents that were watching those movies at one time, and now the younger people, their children, they're not so much interested in that. They don't want to see Chinese language movies. And so that maybe that market is not there the way that it once was. Do you think that's
I think that's true? Partly true, the Hong Kong situation. But maybe
I think it's because we have a generation gap there. So that's why we're different. For the older people, they might want to sit down at home to watch DVD, whatever. They think more easier. So Hong Kong now is potentially more for the younger people movie. If you produce more of those kind of movie, then less adults will come in to watch it. So I think that's the reason, It's usually it's more like young people when they're dating to go to movie.
Right.
But for the old generation, they stay home.
There's a way to think of it in layers along these or historical phases, because right after World War II, for a lot of people, Hong Kong represented a kind of a way station out of China, but people still imagined that they were part of China. And as Poshek mentioned, around the 1970s, late 60s, early 70s, people began to feel that, no, there was a distinctive Hong Kong identity, which was Chinese in a cultural sense or ethnic sense, but not necessarily Chinese in a national in the sense that the mainland represented their national identity. And then I think you have found another generation coming up in the 80s and 90s who identify even perhaps less with even that traditional Hong Kong identity, and more maybe even with kind of pan-Asian identity, so that they can enjoy films from Taiwan, Japanese pop music, Korean movies, things like that, and Western tastes as well, which have become very strong in a lot of the Hong Kong popular culture. So it does seem that maybe this newest generation really responds best to films, Hong Kong films, that have a strong Western accent or have a Japanese accent or remind them of South Korean films. One of the most astonishing phenomena in recent Hong Kong movie market has been the popularity of Japanese movies like The Ring, of Korean movies, gangster movies, but also films that are rather specific to the Korean situation that still have a lot of resonance for the Hong Kong audience, too. It's as if the tastes of this new generation are really sort of pan-Asian or regional tastes and not specifically tied to a Chinese or Hong Kong identity.
Yeah. It seems very clear that directors from other places have taken on some of the conventions of these movies, have seen the kinds of things that Choi Hark and John Woo done in their movies, maybe going even back to the great King Hu, and have incorporated those gestures, those stylistic gestures into their movies. And it sometimes it seems almost that in action filmmaking now, there is an international style that really owes a great debt to these directors.
Yeah, so that's why they use Yuan Heping to do the martial art director. They think it's they're okay, but still, I think it's still different. But that's very normal. You know, we copy yours. You learn from me. You know, I think that's very normal things, though.
Yeah,
right. I think right now, I think Hong Kong or Chinese cinema when it becomes really partly, really fully integrated into parts of the global culture. That is really interact with many other major cultural forms around the world. When in our company, we talk about the hip hop music. It's relations with martial arts movies. And it also is, and with Hollywood, used to be only Hollywood, how the Chinese movie appropriate, but now, you know, the other way around too. So I think right now it's really talk about the global culture, and Hong Kong Chinese cinema become now really, really part of that global culture right now.
Yeah.
Style and content.
Cheng Pei-Pei just mentioned Yuan Woping, who is one of the most famous fight choreographers who did the fight choreography for the Matrix movies.
Yes.
And he also has directed some movies himself.
He directed himself, that's right.
Mm-hmm. Now there are at least a couple of directors. John Woo has made some movies in the United States. So some of these people are becoming known outside of the Hong Kong circle.
Uh-huh.
But I guess I still wonder whether you feel they have gotten the sort of credit that is due to them for the work that they did, which then has inspired other directors.
Well, what I think is really true is I think they do much better when there's Hong Kong. Mm-hmm. Right now, they just use their old things. It's but because the Western people never see it before. So that's why quite interesting. Actually, they got more creative when they was there, but only because they have more money. Because they can use more technique things, you know, to help them to make it more, more bigger, like more dangerous or whatever. Mm-hmm. But like Matrix 2, to me, it's the fighting part is very bad. You
not
know?
Good.
Yeah, because using too much already. Mm-hmm. But mm-hmm. I think Yuan Heping can do much better than that. But when he use all those kind of technique, it depends on those things. It's not what I think martial arts supposed to be.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well,
you agree there?
I think that's true. I think that in a way, Hollywood wants it both ways. They hire people from abroad, and they've been doing this since the 1920s, mm-hmm. because of the distinctive qualities of the people that they hire. They seem to have unique talents. But once they come to Hollywood, they then kind of shave and shape those talents to something that's much more familiar. Although, say, John Woo's films have admirers in the United States, I think his best films were still his 1980s Hong Kong films.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And sure. That's partly because, as Cheng Pei-Pei says, because he has many, many resources now, but the creative impulse of the work, he has more financing, he has more special effects, he has more technical possibilities, but the creative impulse of the works really was tied very much to Hong Kong.
Mm-hmm.
The people of Hong Kong, the stars he had, the issues he wanted to deal with had a rooting in the Hong Kong experience.
Mm-hmm.
And once you cut him off from that, he can make American action movies, genre pictures very well, but it's not the same. It's
even the actor as Sam, you know, Zhou Yun-fat, I think he did much better when he was in Hong Kong movie, but now I don't see any of the Hollywood movie make him, even bigger star.
Now, I wanted to ask you about that because I think he's a wonderful example. I think he's a great performer, has wonderful screen presence, and made a lot of great movies that were made in Chinese in Hong Kong. And somehow he has made some movies in the United States, and they just, it's something's not there, and I guess I'm not exactly sure what.
Yeah, I can't tell. Probably it's the language problem. Mm-hmm. I don't know. But besides the language, I still think it's some things they're missing.
Right. I think I agree with Pepe and David said that kind of source of creativity. I think in some way we can relate to this. I think one of the very famous directors called Low Ka Leung.
Uh-huh.
Recently he gave an interview about Yuan Woping. And he said that Yuan Woping is now doing a lousy job in the U.S. I think what he really said is that because they have to come to U.S. and have to create a certain kind of fighting choreographies in accordance to a taste of the Hollywood. They thought this is Hong Kong style, while in Hong Kong, you have to keep changing, keep innovating, keep looking for a certain new style to keep up with the changing demands of the audience. So that much more established, much more strong sense of that is Hong Kong style that keep them from really running wild that they could do in Hong Kong. I think that is what...
That's a very good point. Yeah. That's a very good point because the Hong Kong audience's tastes change very, very rapidly.
Yeah.
And so if they've seen something even once or twice before, they'll say, well, forget it, it's nothing new.
Yeah. That's why they don't interest in Culture and Tiger, because most things they think they saw before.
It's just too familiar.
They've seen
that's right.
To American audiences, it's like nothing new.
This is Hong Kong movie. It's
one of the most fascinating things, I think, about the Hong Kong situation is, though, even though many of the films are made, it's true for a regional audience rather than a local one, the local one sort of sets the pace. The local one keeps the pressure on the filmmakers. They have to keep outdoing themselves or try something, even as Poshek says, something fairly wild, and that actually leads to more creativity. They also can make films much faster in Hong Kong. Almost every director who's come to the United States has made films at a much slower pace because there's so much meeting, so much development of the script and all these things. In Hong Kong, at least in the 80s and early 90s, you could just go ahead and shoot a movie in 3 weeks and edit it in 2 weeks, and it would be in theaters in a week after that. So that kind of energy that allows sort of you to explore yourself very, very quickly. It's like an artist who can make a lot of sketches very quickly and then maybe choose the best ones and put the colors in. That kind of intensity of creativity is really part of the Hong Kong system, for good or for ill. I mean, it sometimes leads to some rather bad movies, but it also leads to people stretching themselves.
Well, creative.
And in a way that can't be done so easily with the slow and sort of the careful supervision of the suits in Hollywood, because so much money is at stake.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Let me just real quick introduce all of the guests once again, because people have been listening for a while and want to make sure they know who they're listening to. David Bordwell is professor of film studies at the University of Wisconsin-Madison and also director of the Wisconsin Center for Film and Theater Research. And he has written on Hong Kong film. His most recent monograph is titled Planet Hong Kong, Popular Cinema and the Arts of Entertainment. Cheng Pei-Pei is an actress, video producer, television personality, and a very famous Hong Kong film star. Began her career acting with the Shaw Brothers in the late 60s. She was one of the stars of the film Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon, and perhaps the film that made her famous, the one that people might know her for, is the film Come Drink With Me that was released in 1966 and directed by King Hu. And then also with us is Poshek Fu. He's Associate Professor of History and Cinema Studies here at University of Illinois, Urbana-Champaign, and has also written about Hong Kong film. He's the author of the book Between Shanghai and Hong Kong, The Politics of Chinese Cinema, and editor of the Cinema of Hong Kong History, Arts, Identity. And we're not taking calls this morning, so I hope you're enjoying the conversation and you just sit back and listen. When you, Ms. Cheng, how old were you when you went to work for the Shaw Brothers?
I think it's 16, 17.
16, 17 years old. And your training had been in ballet.
It's a ballet.
You were dancing. When
I was 8 years old, I learned ballet. But that time I was in Shanghai. When I moved to Hong Kong, I can't speak Cantonese very well. So I tried to find somewhere else I can speak Mandarin. Shaw Brothers have a training school, which speak Mandarin or Cantonese. So I was one of the students of the training school. After I graduated there, then Shaw Brothers, as an actress there for 7 years contract.
Mm-hmm. So, and you had not, before you made Come Drink With Me, you had not done any martial arts?
No. Not at all. But the thing is that we have a training before they want to do a martial. What we call is like some period they want to do Huang Mi Diao. That's a kind of a Chinese opera. Then after that, they want to do a musical. So each period they want to try some new thing. They have all our actresses or actors. They hire a teacher to teach us. Okay, give us a lot of different kind of training, even riding horse, whatever, you know. So that's why I think I'm a very good student, though. So I pick up very fast. And also because my ballet background, King Wu thinks what he wants is not like exactly Peking Opera's actors. You know, before, they always using Peking Opera to do the martial art film. But he wants me to do more graceful. And also, he wants the tempo. It's different with usually that you see it, you in Beijing Opera. So that's why he asked me if I'm familiar with this kind of tempo. He said, I want you, dung, 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 dung. You know, like this way. I said, oh, I know it. Then, what's that? That's a jazz. I said, see, I'm, so that's why when you see it, you see I'm doing jazz, you know, a dance. Uh-huh. It's not doing a martial art. Uh-huh. But I use my energy. It looks like fighting. That's all.
I think it's interesting. We were talking before we got going, and I made some sort of observation that you were a woman fighter and that mostly it was men who were doing the fighting, and you said, no, this is not true. Yeah. And I think it is something important to recognize that within these films, there have always been very strong women characters.
Yeah.
Women who are not just there for decoration, uh-huh. Women who are very strong. And that perhaps, though, then there would have been a period when there was more emphasis on the male, in action films, on the male performers, like Bruce Lee, Jackie Chan, Jet Li. Probably lots of others.
From Zhang Che, the director Zhang Che, he used more men. That's about the same period what I do, my martial art movie.
Late 60s.
Mm-hmm. The Jamie Wong Yu's coming out, mm-hmm. and Zhang Dawei and Di Long, you know, mm-hmm. all coming out like he think it's more muscle people, make people more believe can fighting than the lady, you know.
Yeah.
So which is true, but that period then changed. Actually, it's before. It's every single film is central on the lady. Mm-hmm. It's not only a martial art movie. Any movie, mm-hmm. you know, mm-hmm. it's lead by the lady.
Yeah,
the Cantonese and Mandarin cinemas of the 1950s in Hong Kong centered on female stars. The star cults were really predominantly females or centered, and it was really changed when the sort of more violent martial arts movies showed up in the late 60s.
Mm.
And as Cheng Xupeipei says, with Zhang Che particularly, who made stars out of several very rugged, virile men heroes, and that tradition continued through Jackie Chan and Sammo Hung in their comic kung fu, which still kept male protagonists, even though it was comedy, you still had a man at the center of the plot. And it really wasn't, I guess I would say, until Choi Hawk started to make films in the 80s that he began to recenter films around strong feminine roles, like Shanghai Blues, Peking Opera Blues. But those aren't strictly martial arts films either.
Mm-hmm. Actually, going back to the 1930s, actually most martial arts movies or what kind of movies, always women were the central characters in Shanghai. And what is interesting too, martial arts movies actually were first developed as a response to the prevalence of Hollywood adventure movies in China. So let's make martial arts movie similar to this kind of movie, like a Robin Hood and things like that. But in China, mostly were women who were the central characters. Partly because of the Beijing Opera, as Pei mentioned too, the Peking operas also have this kind of women characters, very strong. So they carry on this kind of tradition into the movie makings and all the way until the, as David and Pei mentioned, until the really late 60s when Zhang Che directors began to say that it should be the new age. And I think he might be now, we should look at him as a pioneering, look at that in terms of using a new vehicle to project and imagine a new set of Hong Kong, new Hong Kong. There's much more vitality, masculinities, and forward-looking, like a man, you know, a masculine thing. And then Bruce Lee began to really develop the whole things into boom, 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 boom.
The whole war.
Yeah. So I think that is really beginning in the late 60s. But before this, always women, whether fighting or what. And so Crouching Tiger was nothing new. In fact, go back to the whole King Hu traditions.
Yeah. Well, I think Ang Lee really has said that he was making the kind of movie that he watched when he was a boy.
That's mm-hmm. right. That's right.
Yeah.
Which would have been the much older style.
The Shaw Brothers, the Shaw Brothers movies. Yeah. So dominate Taiwan, so dominate the whole Asia Pacific, and Ang Lee was brought up watching and memorizing all these movies. In fact, he memorized all the movies. He memorized the whole things from radio before he went to go to see the movies. So the Come Dream With Me, for example, or Love Return really shaped his vision of China, martial arts movie, or how movies should be like.
Well, it seems like there was this major shift where there was a period where particularly classical Chinese theater in its performance styles influenced movies, and then there was a move into something that would, you maybe for want of a better word, you would call more naturalistic. But then do you still see elements of classical Chinese theater performance style still in movies today?
Yes, still, always, very strong.
Mm-hmm. In fact, to go back,
Yang Heping is the Beijing Opera.
Right, yeah. Exactly. Right. Many of the choreographers trained in Beijing Opera.
Mm-hmm. San Mao, you know, Jackie Chan.
Yeah. They all had
similar.
But actually, they are really can fight. What we believe, they really can fight in the film. Mm-hmm. But if it's really who knows the wushu, you know, martial art, they cannot do it good in a.
That's they're seriously really doing it. Unusual,
yeah. Yeah, Bruce Lee is it's different, and even Jet Li is different too. You know. Yeah.
But even there's a difference because Bruce Lee really did quite self-consciously set out to synthesize various martial arts traditions into a real fighting art.
He invented his own style.
Exactly.
But
exactly.
Because he's an actor.
But he was also an actor, as Zhang Beipei points out, and he went both ways. He was able to be a very powerful presence on the screen by virtue of his skills as an actor, but also at the same time, he's become a kind of hero to people who do actual martial arts. But and Jet Li is a variant of that. But Jet Li, of course, does wuxia, which is more of an acrobatic.
It's
less of a fighting art. It's more of a kind of taking off from traditional fighting arts for performance and kind of quasi dance, quasi acrobatic or athletics.
Yeah. Right. Well,
and so all of those. What makes I think for a lot of us kung fu and wuxia or swordplay films so interesting is you have all these different traditions flowing together, and sometimes one period or one filmmaker emphasizes one, like the Beijing Opera tradition, and someone else will emphasize the wuxia tradition, and it becomes a very, very rich genre. I like to compare it to the Western. The American Western has brought so many different angles of American history and attitudes towards American history and towards social roles and conceptions of the land and so forth, depending on what filmmaker uses the vehicle of the genre, that to me it's, the martial arts film out of Hong Kong is similar in that respect. It's just endlessly interesting.
Well, that's a very interesting point because obviously we have some kind of idea. We're talking about the United States. We have an idea of the West and the idea of the West in the 1800s that has come to us contemporary Americans, by watching movies. You know, who knows what, if any, relationship there was between that and the fact. But that's the way we think about the West. We think about our country. That's part of our mythos. Does that same thing happen with Chinese movies?
Look at Ang Lee. His vision of China was much shaped by all these martial arts movies. Mm. The same kind of thing in some Westerns.
I think we don't have that much things, you know, only watch movie.
Yeah.
You know, you don't have TV, you don't have the other things to do.
Mm-hmm.
When I was young, you know, it's always watch a movie. I can watch 5 movies a day.
Mm.
Yeah, that's the only hobby I have that time. Until now, I'm still love to watch a movie. You know, I think now it's too many things you can.
The other analogy to what you're saying, I think, is quite interesting because people can go back, as with the Western, we can go back and think about not just the West from a new point of view, but think about the films that shaped our understanding of the West. So, for instance, in the 70s, you have so-called revisionist Westerns, particularly after The Wild Bunch. A lot of films that try to debunk or at least criticize the Western tradition as reflected in the earlier movies. And actually, I think you have some of that in Hong Kong, too. I mean, you have a younger generation coming along and rethinking the representations of Hong Kong identity or masculinity or whatever that were not just floating around in the society at the time, but also were seen in the movies or get adaptations. You mentioned Chang Che and his virile masculine heroes. Well, John Woo was an assistant director for Chang Che and was very aware of this, very much influenced by Chang Che, so that when in the 1980s, when he wants to make gangster movies, we get a kind of weird hybrid of an urban, more modern, highly romantic sense of brotherhood that owes a lot, though, to Chang Che's swordplay films. And audiences know when they see Di Lung walk on the screen in A Better Tomorrow that that's not just a character in a movie, nor even just a star, but it's the Di Lung of the Shaw Brothers films of the early 1970s. Mm-hmm. So that he's taking the gangster genre and letting people reflect on the imagery of masculinity that you found 20 years, 15 years earlier. So this kind of recycling and reflection and among practitioners of the genre, I think, does show up in Hong Kong movies.
Yeah, I think right now, I think one thing is that we always try to come up with a certain kind of essential idea of Hong Kong films. But for those in Hong Kong, they're always searching for new things. And then in this search, they always need to go back to the past, theater, old movie-makings or to the West, to the future. So always reconfiguring, reformulating, you know, ideas, always evolving. The whole style keep evolving. And this evolving development is always going back to the past, revisit the past, and look for outside, look for the future. So always changing. I think it's something very important for the film. Yeah. Always keep evolving, keep changing.
Let's just, again, let me real quick reintroduce our guest. Poshak Fu is Associate Professor of History and Cinema Studies at University of Illinois here at Urbana-Champaign. Cheng Pei-Pei is a very famous Chinese film star, made a lot of movies
in
China.
I'm very long.
Oh, no.
40 years already.
Oh, no. Well, I would gush, but I won't. She was one of the stars of the more recent film, Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon, in the role of Jade Fox, and also made a number of movies for the very famous film studio of the Shaw Brothers. Her movie that probably she is most famous for, Come Drink With Me, that was released in 1966. And also David Bordwell. He's professor of film studies at University of Wisconsin-Madison. And just for people who are listening, I also want to say we're not taking calls this morning. This is a recorded interview, but we hope that you're enjoying the conversation. If people were interested in, if they have not sampled this cinema, if they were interested in trying to see some of these movies, and what they're going to have to do is obviously go to a place and rent them, unless they're lucky enough to stumble onto a Hong Kong film festival. And occasionally in big cities, you might be able to see that. But
it's not
probably,
really, though. Right now, they have released a DVD and a VCD now.
So there are now lots of... You can go out and you can find these movies to see.
Actually, the Celestial bought the whole library of Shaw Brothers. They redo it. I mean, to make the digital, how do you say that?
Restoration.
Yeah, that's
so
right.
It looks nice and sharp. And
yeah, that's right. Remastered. Like a new one.
So people could, for example, could rent Come Drink With Me, and they could.
At least Come Drink With Me, you can get it.
See you. Yeah, good see you. Well, are there, would you like to mention maybe one or two titles of films that you'd say, well, if you would like to go and see some of the kind of movies we've been talking about, here's a place to start. Try a few of these. Well, maybe I only asked David Bordwell, you know, give us a couple.
Apart from Come Drink With Me, for things that are available for people to see on video, I guess I would pick two. I would pick Bruce Lee's second film, A Chinese Connection, which is a crucial film, I think, because that's his, it's also known as Fist of Fury. It's his rethinking of the Chinese martial arts tradition. It's a very interesting movie in its own right, and it ends with one of the most famous sort of iconic images of Bruce Lee defying a whole bunch of men with pistols by leaping in the air at them. The other film I think I would recommend is John Woo's breakthrough film of the 80s, A Better Tomorrow, starring Leslie Cheung, Chow Yun-fat, and Di Lung, which is a kind of, as I was saying earlier, a kind of rethinking or remake of some of the Shaw's martial arts films. Those are fairly accessible on video for American audiences, and they give a bit of the flavor of this. They don't cover the whole range of possibilities. There's a lot more interesting, other interesting films available, but those two are very easy to see, and I think give a good introduction to some of the issues we've been talking about.
Well, aside from your own movies, what would you suggest people might like to see?
I don't know if anybody loves to see some musical. We have Hong Kong, how do you say the Hong Kong?
Nocturne.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's right. That's a musical for 60. Yeah, if you're interesting Hong Kong musical. Yeah.
It's really 60s, too. It has the 60s. It speaks to the 60s. Yeah. It's the 60s.
Also, she's a star in it, too.
So people should see that. And if they can find Come Drink With Me, they can watch that, too.
Yeah.
Well, what do you think, Poshak?
I like several ones, actually. One is I like is the One-Armed Swordsman by Zhang Che. Really began the new age of the kind of masculine, vitality and things like that. Also, I really like another one. I don't want an action movie. I think musical right now. Also, there's a melodrama, very typical of Chinese melodrama to project the kind of Hong Kong identity. Is An Hui's movie. Is it Homecoming? Is it Homecoming or called Farewell?
It's Yim Ho.
No, yeah. So, Ha Tou Chou Hen, Ke Tou Chou Hen.
It's her own story.
Yeah, her own story.
Song of the Exile.
Yeah, Song of Exile. That's a very good movie by Anne Hui.
I think a lot of your listeners would like that film.
That's kind of family male drama, but talk about like a very strong transnational, transcultural context of a woman's search for identities of the 1980s. So I think these two are good films to look at the changes of the women, if you want only two movies.
Okay.
But there's so many.
Yeah. Well, it's a very rich film tradition. There are lots and lots of films, and no doubt something for any taste.
We have some comedy too.
Yeah.
If you want Stephen Chow's movie, it's a comedy.
Michael Hoy. I'm a big admirer of Michael Hoy's films from the 1970s, like The Private Eyes or Security Unlimited.
Yeah.
But as Pepe says, certainly Stephen Chow. Many of Stephen Chow's films are extremely funny. I think for an American audience, maybe the most approachable is this more recent film, Shaolin Soccer. Also
it's
known
coming
as,
up here
as
too.
Kung Fu Soccer in some markets.
I think that based upon the success of Crouching Tiger, some people thought, American audiences saw that movie and they thought, wow, this is great, that they would want to see more and that would create opportunities for Chinese films in, in the United States. And I wonder if, in fact, that happened.
I think not. I think it didn't create so many opportunities. I think it was seen as a one-off. Of course, there's always the possibility that the Zhang Yimou film called Hero, which has been finished for some time and has played around the world but has not yet opened in the U.S., it might test that to see if people would like to see something that's a little more experimental, maybe a little more arty or artful or whatever you like. Mm-hmm. But that's been held back from distribution for some time. My sense is that American audiences, apart from the kung fu and swordplay films, are most exposed to the sort of the festival cinema of Hong Kong, the art cinema, like Wong Kar-wai's films, Chungking Express, or In the Mood for Love. Those films are quite easy to see here on video, and they represent a kind of cinema that's almost just a cult cinema, really, in Hong Kong, but has a huge following among the intellectuals and artistic audiences around the world. So that's another whole side of Hong Kong cinema we haven't touched on.
That's true. I guess you'd have to also say we're sort of in a sense talking about popular film.
Right.
I don't want to disparage it in any way by giving it that label. But then there are art films like those films or the films made by
Wong Kar-wai.
I'm thinking of Chen Kai-ge.
Chen Kai-ge was mainland director. But the interesting point you make is that Hero really falls between the two because it takes a popular genre, the Zhang Yimou film, takes a popular genre from a mainland stance, but then treats it as if it were a kind of art film or a festival, and a very artfully directed and self-consciously stylized, things like that. And I think the gamble is whether an American audience that liked the drama of Crouching Tiger, but also like the action scenes, but I think mainly the drama, whether they can transfer their affection to something that's a bit more abstract.
Yeah. But to me, I put it this way. I think it's Crouching Tiger, even it's not only East, it's plus the West. You know, it's actually have more West things come. It's not really it's a Hong Kong and China movie, actually, to me. Mm-hmm. Okay. Especially for the love scene. See, let's go back to way back to that period. I don't think a woman and a man would do something like Zi, the younger couple. Mm-hmm. You know, so I think that bring up the audience more close, then more understand that's a different kind of tradition of love. But I think it's difficult for Zhang Yimou's movie because he's very tradition based on very tradition, and I think it's difficult to understand why the king is so important. You know. That's, I think, still, I think Ang Lee is making a Hollywood movie. It's not Chinese movie.
Well, that's true. And one of the things I thought was interesting about The Crouching Tiger when I saw it, after having seen, maybe 20 or 30 Hong Kong films, I thought, in no Hong Kong film would people spend that much time talking about their feelings.
Right. Yeah.
These long dialogues of people talking about how they felt and what was going on inside. It would never happen.
I'll tell you the truth. King Wu's movie, never have a love scene.
Right. Mm-hmm.
The man and a woman, even not touch, they have a baby already. that's something very different, But Ang Lee used a lot of footage to talk about two generations love.
Right, two couples, and then their
the older couple.
Make the people understand why the older couple is different with the now, more than, I think it's more introduced.
Yeah, I can see that. There seemed to be such longing and yet such hesitance in Michelle and
Zhou Yun-fat,
and that yet the younger couple they're so wild
passionate.
Very Western,
and it's very
probably for Andy, Yin is always about the new and old, East and West.
Yeah.
Why for Zhang Qie, King Hu,
they
do not have this kind of cultural package. I mean, they just seem to say this is China.
Yeah, that's it. Chinese.
So I mean, the kind of theme is very different. But at the same time, Andy is also brought up in different kind of cultural, intellectual background. You know,
For the industry, the Hong Kong industry, I think it was 1992, I think, was the peak box office year, and it's been going down steadily since. And I think I read, you know, one of the articles that I read, there was a quote from Jackie Chan saying something like, you know, if things don't get better pretty soon, that's going to be the end.
It's getting better this year.
Things are better?
Yeah. And I think it's because they have future for the China market, which is, I don't know, it's good enough, but still feeling, you know, they have some kind of rule for China. They give a kind of better deal for the Hong Kong movie, you know. Mm-hmm. Now it's a Hong Kong movie, some kind of like a China movie, you know. So give us a room to have our own market. I don't know if this market's open, that's a huge. Mm-hmm. That can make Hong Kong films much better.
Mm-hmm. One of the things I was really very curious about was how things for the industry in Hong Kong had changed with the control of Hong Kong passing from Britain to the mainland Chinese.
I don't think the change is because of that. I think the change is because of the whole economy. Mm-hmm. It's not only Hong Kong.
97 was the focus of a lot of things. Mm-hmm. There was the handover, but also there was the poultry flu. Yeah. There was the collapse of a lot of Asian currencies, so that Hong Kong films abroad in that Southeast Asian market they command were not getting their money back. And the whole sort of moment, that moment of late 1997, contributed to a process of decline that was already in motion, as you say, by 92 or 93. Mm-hmm. But I agree that there's a sense in which there are two things really have given filmmakers new hope. One is, as Cheng Pei-Pei mentioned, the possibility of opening the China market. That has been dangled in front of them for a decade, the possibility that it might happen. But now it might actually happen, it seems, with the collapse of China's own film industry, plus the possibility that China will indeed work out some sort of arrangement whereby they can make some money off these films. That will happen. The other is the success of Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon. That gave enormous hope to Hong Kong filmmakers because they realized that a Chinese language film made with only Asian stars, no Hollywood stars in the film, could become the highest grossing foreign film in the United States in history. That is a really remarkable achievement, and it gave them enormous pride. But it also said, if we can do it once, maybe we can do it again. And that too, I think, is a source of hope for local filmmakers.
Mm-hmm. By the way, the China market right now, as Pei-Pei just mentioned, right now there's also signed a new agreement between China and Hong Kong.
Yeah,
there'll be much more closer economic cooperation and give Hong Kong much better access into the China market. So that will become a really huge, huge source of support for the industry. Mm-hmm. That's at least give hope to many in the industry.
There is one downside to this. I'll just interject this fast. There is already a growing sense, I think, in Hong Kong that because of the opening of the China market, the more and more Hong Kong filmmakers will start to shape their films for some imagined either audience or board of censors, or in some way change the tastes of the film to reflect the taste of a different audience. And filmmakers are already speculating about maybe this is a mixed blessing.
Well, that was the question in my mind too. If you're going to start distributing films in all of China, obviously there may be some things that you're not going to be able to do, or that is you're not going to be able to say, and that's you know maybe some filmmakers would say, well, fine, I don't care, I'm not interested in making political statements, and others would say, well, I don't want to work under those kind of restrictions.
But at the same time, you might be giving them more creative energy to try new way to say things in a much more interesting and exciting ways. I mean, look, I mean, Chiang Kai-ge, I mean, all those many, Tian Zhuang, many very good Chinese character directors could always say very strong political message in the movies. I think the Hong Kong film directors, filmmakers, could creatively use those opportunities in many different respects. I don't think it will only see only restrictions or any problems. They will see also open up another new vistas of possibilities and creative opportunities in some way, I think.
Well, it was the third biggest industry. Right. India was number one. Hollywood was number two. So it was Bollywood and Hollywood. And then it was Hong Kong.
Hong Kong would.
For a short period, from about 86 to 92, that's right.
Right.
Japan has always been a hugely prolific industry.
Yeah.
And until India really took over in the 60s, Japan made more movies than any country,
right.
any country by far.
I think Korea is doing very good.
Well, Korea, Korea currently, but historically. And then Hong Kong hit its peak, as you say, around the early 90s. But now I think it puts out 100 to 120 movies a year, sometimes less, like 80 or so. I think it'll do 100 or so this year. It doesn't make it hugely prolific, of course, compared to European film industries, except for France, it is. But what's interesting, though, is the export market. It is really the world, and it has for a long time been the world's second largest export market, exporting industry. And that is really, as Poshek has said, that's really its base of operation.
Well, that's, I guess, one thing as a way of finishing up, that's what I wonder is, would it ever be that again? You know, what it was at the point of the peak.
Well, we all hope so.
There are two schools of thought. One is more movies doesn't mean better movies. I'm of the feeling that you have to make a lot of bad movies to make a few good ones.
Yeah.
And that's, I think, Hong Kong, Hollywood proves that, many industries. Quantity really gives people a chance to experiment, gives them a chance to learn their craft. They work a lot. They get new ideas. And the good films come out if you've made quite a lot of them. And I think that's the way certainly Hong Kong worked in its golden years.
Oh, just want to get a bit more thing. I agree with David and PP on this thing. I think Hong Kong industry or chain industries all went through the crisis many, many times in the 50s, in the 60s, 70s. So I think even now a new market, a new audience might create a new opportunities, and this opportunity might create new creative energy. So probably
if you know you know Hong Kong people, then you think you will, because Hong Kong people never fall. They always stay out.
The dynamics.
Never quit. Jackie Chan, the emblem of the Hong Kong.
Never give up.
Say die.
Never give up.
Yeah. Like Bruce Lee, too. Just keep on fighting.
All right. Well, I think we'll have to leave it at that point. I want to thank the guests here. Poshek Fu, he's Associate Professor of History and Cinema Studies, University of Illinois, here at Urbana-Champaign. Chinese film star, actress, video producer, television personality, Cheng Pei-Pei, and David Bordwell. He's professor of film studies, University of Wisconsin-Madison, director of the Wisconsin Center for Film and Theater Research. Thank you all very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.